Welcome to the Superstars of Astronomy podcast from Astronomy Magazine. I'm Dave Eicher, Editor-in-Chief of Astronomy. Each month, I'll share the thoughts and research of the world's greatest astronomers, astrophysicists, cosmologists, and planetary scientists with you in these hour-long chats. Superstars of Astronomy is brought to you by Celestron. From your first telescope to precision observatory-grade instruments, Celestron has the perfect telescope to suit your experience level and budget. You can find out more at celestron.com. I'm excited to have a distinguished guest for our 10th show, Michael Rampino. Mike is a little bit of a different guest for us today. He is Associate Professor of Biology at New York University. He's both a biologist and a geologist and has a broad range of interests that focus on life on Earth, Earth as a planet, volcanology, the evolution of life, mass extinctions, and more. His expertise ranges through many aspects of Earth as a planet and also important themes in astrobiology. He's well known for producing an important paper on the future of life on Earth. We'll discuss the whole range of his interests and research today. So without further ado, Mike, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
Well, thank you. And let's get right into it, because you're in one of these very complex positions where you're rolling a lot of disciplines together to look at both Earth as a planet and dangers to Earth as and life on Earth as a planet, and also life and the evolution of life and the past life and future life. So you've got all sorts of things going on here. How did you get interested in such a wide variety of topics when you were younger?
Well, I did my PhD had to do with climate change, and it was a PhD in geology. But I've always been interested in astronomy and biology as well. So after I did my PhD on climate, I got a postdoc at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, working with Bob Jastrow, well-known astronomer. And we began to investigate not only the climatic effects of things like volcanoes, but also the idea that the climate could be generated, could be changed by things from outer space, like impacts.
Yes, indeed. And what was working with Bob Jastrow like? He's a legend in astrobiology.
Well, he was a very smart guy. I sometimes thought that I could hear the wheels of the gears turning in his head as he focused on a problem, but he was very, very good at pointing out very, very interesting problems and then solving them.
And were you interested as a young child in science, and how did you originally get into this multidisciplinary approach? Did that interest come younger, or really when you were college aged?
Well, no, I decided to become a geologist when I was about 7 years old.
Wow.
After visiting the American Museum of Natural History here in New York, and their incredible display of minerals, rocks and minerals that they had there. I was very impressed by that. And as a kid, I collected rocks, went out to vacant lots and parks and things, and tried to collect rocks and minerals in New York City. And that's how I sort of got into it. I decided I would be a geologist. The two things I wanted to do, one was to be a geologist, and the other was to travel as much as possible to all these places that I was seeing, you know, in school on maps, all these exotic places, and I really wanted to do to travel and do geology as part of that traveling.
Fantastic. And how did the astronomical component, the Earth as a planet, come into the picture?
Well, I discovered that most of the interesting problems in science are at the boundary between two sciences or more, two or more sciences.
Yes.
And so this, I combined finding an interest in geology and astronomy, because geology is really just a branch of planetary science when you look at it that way, and planetary science is just a branch of astrophysics. So they're all intertwined. And then you throw biology in, you can look at the effects of the effects of astronomical ideas, astronomical processes on biological and geological events.
Well, that's fantastic, and I love rocks and minerals as well, and that the Morgan Collection there in New York City is one of the greatest in the world, of course. That's an easy place to be inspired walking into that gallery. Of course, J.P. Morgan did a pretty nice job putting a collection together, but, you know, I've got a lot of friends and readers of the magazine here who have said, well, what, you're into astronomy, what the heck, you know, are you a mineral collector for? And, of course, the universe puts minerals together. That's how the universe builds planets, really, is to put atoms together in specific ways that make minerals. It's really planetary geology that you can extrapolate not only on Earth, but out to other rocky planets here, there, and everywhere as well, isn't it?
Sure. Well, you know, Martian meteorites are available, rocks from Mars, lunar samples from the Apollo mission, lunar meteorites. So mineralogy can also combine with planetary science and astronomy as well.
Absolutely. One of the things that you've really gotten into has been the issue of mass extinctions. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we have a reasonably good story about the KPG or KT impact, the dinosaur killer 66 million years ago. But we really don't know a whole lot about about the causes of some of the other major mass extinctions that we know have taken place in Earth's relatively recent history.
Yes, well, I got interested, you know, when the Alvarez paper came out back in Science back in 1980, proposing that there was evidence for a large body impact at the time of the dinosaur extinction, I stopped whatever else I was doing and immediately focused on this problem because I realized that was the most exciting thing that was going to go on in geology during my lifetime. I started just at the time when the plate tectonics was coming in, and we had one revolution in geology in the 1960s, and now it seems that we're in the midst of another revolution, and that is to not only look at things that go on the Earth, but look at other bodies in the solar system and how they might affect things that go on the planet.
Absolutely, and you took you've taken many field trips, but did you get involved with going traveling around the world a bit specifically to study the, as it was then called, KT impact in the 1980s and 90s?
Yes, that was a nice thing about it. Boundary layer, this layer that was rich in iridium and other indications that it's a fallout layer from an impact, is global. And so one can go all over the world, and if one can find the geological time frame of about 66 million years ago, then one can find the thin layer of fallout that marks the time of the mass extinction. So it's really a global study. This clay layer is all around the world at that time. There are other mass extinctions in the geological record, and they also can be found all around the world, geological sections of those other mass extinctions. And so this is really a global problem of geological fieldwork in many, many areas of the world.
But it's a really difficult and tricky problem to confront because the evidence is so, it's difficult to tease out. Now, things sort of came together for the dinosaur killing impact of 66 million years ago because of the evidence of the subsurface impact crater in the Yucatan and so on. But the other major mass extinction events, how do you attack that as a scientific problem? That's a really, really difficult thing to investigate, isn't it?
Well, many people, even in geology, don't realize how difficult that is because you're looking for, you know, the layer at the time of the dinosaur extinction, that thin layer in the sediments is only a few millimeters thick. Mm. And so when you're confronted with an outcrop, you know, hundreds of meters across, and you're looking for maybe a 1 millimeter or 1 centimeter layer, it's really a needle in a haystack because there are many, many other layers which look like that that could be related to impacts They look just like the impact layer. So unless one goes out and gets an idea, first of all, where the mass extinction takes place in the geological record, where in the rocks do you see the mass extinction, and then focus in on that level, one has to take very, very closely spaced samples. You have to do a very, very careful job. You just go out there and take a sample every few meters or every few tens of centimeters, likely you'll miss the very thin layer. So it's a job of very, very intense stratigraphic study to find impact layers at other times of mass extinction. And so it's not surprising that we haven't found that many that I think are out there, but they've been very, very difficult to find. Most people go out and take very, very widely spaced samples, and then they don't take enough sample. These elements are there in parts per billion range, even the shock quartz. It's one grain of quartz per sample. And so you have to take a very, very large sample, closely spaced together, which is a hard thing to do, and so most people don't do it.
And is it fairly clear to say, because of the difficulty and the enormous volume of rock and the limited number of scientists and funding, there's probably a lot of evidence of other very major impacts that is yet to be discovered in rock layers on Earth?
Both in rock layers, I'm sure there are many more impact layers in the rocks at various ages, and also the other evidence of impact on the Earth being impact craters.
Yes.
And we know we have about 150 or 160 known impact craters on the Earth, and we know the number must be much, much higher than that. And so there are a lot of craters that are hiding out there. Either they've been eroded or covered over in some way, and in fact, even the Chicxulub crater at the KT boundary is not visible from the surface of the Earth. It's buried completely. And so it's only through geophysical, petroleum techniques of petroleum geology to see what was under the overlying rocks and to drill down into those rocks that we now know that there is, in fact, a crater there, and the melted rock in that crater is 66 million years old, exactly the time of the demise of the dinosaurs.
So this, correct me if I'm wrong, it's essentially universally accepted that we have a good picture of that impact and understand the cause, and it wasn't this asteroid striking the Yucatan. There's no question about that.
Well, there's still a few holdouts
okay.
in geology.
Okay.
Yes, especially the dinosaur vertebrate paleontologists are very, very... They don't like this idea of death coming from above to kill off their wonderful dinosaurs. And so they've been hesitant, I would say, to some extent, to accept this idea. But the evidence is so hard, it's so solid, and the timing between the mass extinction event, which takes place very, very rapidly, it must have been catastrophic, and the timing of the impact layer, in fact, the dating of the impact layer radiometrically and the dating of the asteroid impact and the dates of that we get from the Chicxulub crater are exactly the same. They're 66 million years of age, and so there's no doubt in most people's mind who study this problem that there's no doubt that there's a connection between this giant impact on the Earth and the extinction of the dinosaurs and 75% of all the other species on the planet in a very, very short period of time.
Yes, yes. And let's talk just for a moment about radiometric dating for the listeners who are not familiar with how this works. How is it that we can definitively date rocks from the radioactive components within them, like zircons and other other minerals or crystals that are contaminated by radioactive isotopes?
Well, to put it very simply, there are radioactive atoms that are incorporated in rocks, and they are unstable. They give off little bits of energy, and particles come shooting out of the nuclei of these elements. And one element, by losing particles and energy, is transformed into another element. And so, for example, uranium which is a very radioactive substance. Its nucleus is very unstable. It gives off particles and gamma radiation, and it turns into the nucleus of the element lead. And so that if you have uranium in the rocks, it's turning into lead all the time. And so if you do some very careful tests, but if you measure the ratio between the original uranium, what's left, and the lead, that ratio gives, since the radioactive decay is a constant, the same under any circumstances, radioactive decay is constant, you find that you can date the rocks by the ratio of uranium to lead in minerals like zircon, which contain a lot of uranium.
It's a very nice natural clock to have in this detective story.
It's a beautiful natural clock, and it works. You know, sometimes you have two or three radioactive elements in the same rocks, and so you can check one age against another, and they are, most of the time they come out, for example, the moon rocks were dated by uranium lead, they were dated by potassium argon dating, and some other kinds of dating, and the ages all came out the same. So one process sort of checks on the other.
And you get that nice, comfortable confirmation that science really works with that process.
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Now, you've also done a great deal of research on the Permian-Triassic extinction. Roughly 252 million years ago, the so-called Great Dying, the largest extinction event of life, I believe, in the history of the planet. Tell me a little bit about that and all the work and investigation that you've done on that largest extinction event.
Well, the Permian-Triassic boundary is the largest extinction event. It's something like 96% of the species of life that were alive at that time died out. And of course, if you study mass extinctions, you're always interested in the biggest. That's the biggest prize, is to figure out what exactly happened 252 million years ago to kill off. And again, it looks like from the geological record, this was very fast, maybe a few thousand years, I think. And so something very, very catastrophic, which did in all these different kinds of species, marine animals, reptiles, mammal-like reptiles on the land, was across the board. Life took a big hit at that time. And so going around the world and looking for the KT boundary was one thing I did, but also I and some other people working together decided to focus in also on geological sections around the world that contained what's called the Permian-Triassic boundary, the line marking the mass extinction of life that took place at that time. And that's taken me, to the Western United States, to Italy, to South Africa, to Japan, all these places you can go and you can put your finger on the place in the rocks where the mass extinction took place in a very, very short instant of geological time.
And where are we now with understanding this? What do we really know about the Permian-Triassic? It was the largest, 96% of the species, was it, of life?
Yes. 96% of species, marine animals, plants on land took a very big hit, and reptiles and mammal-like reptiles on the land also were very, very hard hit in that extinction event.
And where are we with the – this is such a huge detective story to take on that involves so much about the history of Earth and evidence that's scattered everywhere. Where are we in understanding the causation of that? Is there any feeling that we have any evidence at all of what the cause might have been there?
Well, unfortunately, the evidence of causation at the time of the Permian-Triassic mass extinction is not as clear as it is for the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction 65 million years ago. We know there are sections of the world which contain the boundary, which contain the time of the mass extinction, and iridium and shock minerals and things like that were looked for at that boundary. And there were some reports that they were found, but most of the geologists don't believe the evidence really supports the fact, the idea that a large impact was also due, that the extinction at the end of the Permian period was also due to a large impact. I'm not so sure you can rule that out, because as I said earlier, you're looking for a needle in a haystack, and you're very easy to miss the few millimeters or centimeter or so of clay that would contain the impact debris. And there is a crater in South America that I've been to, called Araguena Crater. It is about 40 kilometers in diameter, so it's not as big as the Chicxulub Crater, you know, at the KT boundary. That's 180 to 200 kilometers in diameter. But there is a 40-kilometer diameter crater in Brazil, which dates exactly 252 million years ago. And so most people would say, well, that crater is not big enough to have caused a major mass extinction. And my answer is, well, do you really know how big a crater has to be? It may be also be determined by what it hits and how stable or unstable the biosphere is at the time this happens. Or maybe there was a shower of impactors, and we found one of them, you know, the crater in Brazil, and maybe there are others that are hiding from us that we haven't yet discovered. It was so hard to find the KT crater, one could imagine it'll be even harder to find a crater from the end of the Permian period.
Absolutely. And could it have been a shower or even a single object that was of much lower density, so there was much more atmospheric ablation and energy into the atmosphere and a relatively small nucleus of material that impacted?
That could be. You know, we don't know whether it was an asteroid at the KT boundary or whether it was a comet.
Mm-hmm.
And comets, though they're made up largely of ice, and they're traveling about three times faster than asteroids do.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you hit the Earth with whipped cream, you know, going 60 kilometers per second, you still have an explosion and you still make a crater. So either a comet or asteroid would still fit the bill for the end of the Cretaceous extinction business. But we don't know for sure. We haven't yet found an impact large enough, most people would say, although I doubt you can really tell how large they have to be. But it's not generally accepted now that impact at the Permian-Triassic boundary, it was caused by, that the mass extinction, I should say, was caused by an impact. There's some other ideas. There was a large volcanic extrusion in Siberia at that time. A massive flood of lava came out of the earth and formed what we call the Siberian Traps. And the dates of the Siberian Traps are suspiciously close to the 252 million-year-old date of the mass extinction.
Hmm.
So some people, and me included, I should say, think that the volcanism might have had something to do with the mass extinction. Not ruling out the fact that there could have been an impact, but perhaps this extreme volcanism had a big effect on the environment and therefore on the fossil record.
And what do we know? You know, we've heard there have been, you know, Science Channel television shows about the eventual eruption, you know, of Yellowstone and things like that. What do we know about? We know that there certainly could be future, will be if we wait long enough, future relatively large asteroids again. There could be things like nearby supernovae or gamma ray bursts and so on. What does the future hold? Because you study volcanology a great, great deal as well. What about future danger from volcanism on Earth?
Well, you know, the Earth is not a safe place.
Yes.
If you look at the fossil record, something like 99.9% of the species that have ever existed are extinct.
Mm-hmm.
When you go out fossil hunting, you find extinct organisms. There are billions of them. And so there are many, many more extinct organisms in the fossil record than are living organisms, living species at present. So clearly, lots of things have gone extinct. And and part of that extinction has been that a number of these major mass extinctions have taken place, in which a large percentage of the forms of life at that time became extinct. So the Earth is a dangerous place. We have asteroids, we have supernova, we have volcanic eruptions that happen from time to time. And if one waits long enough, one will see the results of those very, very extreme effects.
And the time scales, fortunately, are usually extremely large, long. But we feel, you know, we're driving around in our cars. We have houses here and there. We have a nice daily life on Earth. We have a feeling of security that perhaps in the long, long run, we shouldn't have, living on this planet, feeling like everything is under control. It's really not.
It's a false sense of security. You know, geologists used to think that the only gradual changes took place in the geologic record, that things only happen gradually. Mm-hmm. And that's because our lifespan is not long enough to see, to experience these catastrophic events, which might not happen for millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years, but they are the turn out to be the most important events. All the gradual stuff that goes on between these mass extinctions is not very important. Mm-hmm. It's the mass extinction in which large numbers of the species of life become extinct. And then the ecological niches are now open for new species, for other forms of life to radiate and fill those ecological niches. And that's the way I think the evolution works. It's not so much the little tinkering, things changing gradually in a sort of Darwinian competition sense. The real changes take place when something comes along and wipes out the ruling species and allows the other species to begin to this evolutionary radiation and filling those niches. And we see that at the end of the dinosaur epoch. The dinosaurs go extinct very, very rapidly. They were doing fine. There's no evidence that they were dying out. But they were killed off, most likely in this big asteroid or comet impact. And the mammals who were coexisting with the dinosaurs for millions, tens of millions of years and not going anyplace, they found themselves that, you know, they inherited the world. The mammals began to radiate, evolutionary radiation took place, and mammals, all the present-day mammals, come from one little sort of rat-like mammal that managed to survive the impact and the extinction and go on to populate the world with all the different kinds of mammals that we see today. So we went from the age of dinosaurs to the age of mammals very, very, very quickly. I show my students every semester. I put a picture of the little rat-like animal up on the screen, and I say, you know, there's your ancestors. maybe that explains a lot about us, but that's the ancestor of all the modern-day mammals, everything from cats and dogs to elephants and zebras and lions and tigers and whatever, all come from one little or maybe a group of these very, very small gerbil-like animals that survived the mass extinction. I don't know exactly how. Probably they lived in burrows. They were protected in some way. They could get out of the way of the effects of this impact. And therefore, they came out of their burrows and inherited the world from the dinosaurs. So there was no real competition, as people used to think, competition between mammals and reptiles, and somehow the mammals won because they were better. The dinosaurs were huge, and these little gerbil things were, you know, the mammals were little gerbil-like things. There was no competition between them. You had to wipe out the dinosaurs before the mammals ever get their chance to become what we see today.
And the little mammal guys needed a relatively limited amount of food to live on, unlike all of the dinosaurs as well. I've sometimes heard them described, our forebears, our mammal forebears at that time, described as something more or less like those 13-lined ground squirrels, or what we used to call chipmunks, maybe erroneously, in Ohio. Is that more or less accurate?
No, I envision them as more gerbil-like. I think they had more mouse-like. They had tails, certainly. Yeah. We have the fossils of their little jaws, you know. So more like, I guess, a modern-day shrew.
Yes.
Would be a good example of that.
So this was not the taming of the shrew. This was the triumph of the shrew at that time.
You said that.
Now, you have done an enormous amount. Speaking of, we're talking about volcanism, you've also done a lot of work on the role of volcanic eruptions in climate change, studying volcanoes in Indonesia and elsewhere as well.
Yes, that's my original. That's how I got into the impact extinction problem, is I was working on the effect of volcanoes on the atmosphere.
Yes.
On the atmosphere, And it seemed to fit well with this the idea now that the atmosphere would be greatly affected by an impact by putting all the dust from the crater and the ash from the burning vegetation into the atmosphere and causing a cooling in the same way that we've experienced coolings, global coolings after large terrestrial volcanic eruptions. And this is 2015 is the 200th anniversary of a very big volcanic eruption that took place in Indonesia called Tambora in April 1815, and put so much material into the stratosphere, very, very fine volcanic ash and little droplets of sulfuric acid that spread around the world and gave the incredible sunsets. These tiny particles refracted the sunlight, and they gave beautiful sunsets, but also they cut out some of the incoming sunlight and cooled things down. And in fact, the next year, 1816, the summer of 1816 is called the year without a summer, because the summer was almost non-existent. People were planting, this is in Europe and in the northeastern United States especially, people would plant crops, there'd be a freeze, we'd kill the crops, they'd try planting again, and they had snow and ice in July and August. And so pretty widespread problems with famine, even in places like Europe and Eastern North America. The crops just failed. It was a very bad wine year. If you ever get a bottle of wine from 1816, the grapes didn't do very well that year, so it's not a very good wine. But it did have this global effect. And there were other eruptions. Tambora is just the biggest in the last few hundred years. But every now and then, a volcano erupts. And if it's explosive enough, it puts material up into the stratosphere, which is spread around the world and cuts out the sunlight and causes a cooling. And the last time that significantly happened was in 1991, when this eruption called Pinatubo in the Philippines went off. And put stuff up in the stratosphere, and it cooled the climate for a couple of years. And some people said, well, look, global warming must be over because the climate is getting cooler. And they didn't realize that this is a temporary phenomenon. The ash and the dust falls out within a couple of years. And so after that atmosphere cleaned itself out, the global warming went right back to what was before. So these are important events in the history of climate. Major explosive volcanic eruptions.
And a major eruption of that is just one minor little taste toward the huge impact after effect that Carl Sagan used to talk about as a nuclear winter scenario then. Getting back to the impact.
The biggest explosive volcanic eruptions are called super eruptions.
Yes.
And they happen about once every, 50,000 years or so. And they are, I talked about Tambora. These things, people remember Mount St. Helens maybe back in 1980. These super eruptions are 1,000 times or more the size of the Mount St. Helens eruption of 1980. So this puts a tremendous amount of stuff in fine material up into the stratosphere around the world, and leads to a cooling, and that makes almost like a nuclear winter kind of phenomenon. We call it volcanic winter, and the temperatures around the world would drop precipitously, and there would be significant problems with feeding the world, because probably for several years crops would fail and wither, and the food supply would be seriously threatened from an eruption like that. Luckily, they don't occur that often, but when they do, they have an effect on the Earth.
But these will happen again. Now, and again, it may be like a 1 kilometer asteroid impact. It may be a tremendously long time from now, but this will happen again on Earth, will it not?
Yes. Yes, you can. There are a number of these big calderas all around the world, which are evidence. These are big volcanic craters that are evidence that there was a super eruption that took place. And they happen, a few tens of thousands of years between them. And so they don't happen that often, but when they do, they're very catastrophic. In fact, the last really big one big super eruption was in 74,000 years ago in a place called Toba in Sumatra in Indonesia. And that eruption probably caused a worldwide problem in terms of the climate and food supply. And it is interesting that if one looks at human evolution, that just about 70,000 years ago, there are evidence that geneticists tell us that the human population went through a bottleneck and the population crashed. Maybe to only 10,000 or maybe even less human beings on the Earth. And that crash makes us all much more like each other than we normally be because we all went through that very, very narrow bottleneck 70,000 years ago. And it is interesting that the biggest natural event that took place at about that time is the Toba eruption of 74,000 years ago. So there may be a connection between our evolution and our development and the very, very large environmental changes caused by volcanoes.
That's absolutely amazing. And we talked a bit about climate change. You've been involved in studying climate change, both at very short timescales of decades, as in global warming, to hundreds of millions of years. Let's talk a little bit about climate change and your work on it. And let me just throw out there right away, you know, it astonishes me, Mike, how so many very smart people on this planet believe in science sometimes selectively. And really, science isn't about selective belief. you have to either go with science or you don't. Set the politics aside, if you will, or if you want, or if listeners want to. They're even aside from some of the political connections, there's such a knee-jerk reaction among many, many people, and they are chiefly Americans, to not believe in the science of climate. Why is that?
Well, there are probably many, many reasons, but one reason I think is the reluctance of people to accept the idea that something that we're doing that benefits us, meaning industrialization, has had this negative effect on the climate. Mm-hmm. It's just hard for them to put things together. It's something that is really, we've utilized the industrialization of the world and using fossil fuels, and that somehow that doesn't seem right to them, that should have some these negative effects on climate. And I think there's a religious aspect to that, but there's also just a general aspect, I think, of people not minding and what they do every day, driving to work in their car or getting in an airplane and flying from New York to California, that they're doing something negative to the environment while they're just living their lives as best as they can.
I can't be doing that because I'm a good, well-intending person and fine American, and don't lay that blame on me.
I think that's part of it, yes. I think that is the point. Apart from all politics, which I try to stay away from, but I think there is that aspect of not wanting to accept the fact that we're doing this experiment to the atmosphere, this global experiment.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you may, for the most anti-scientific folks I've come across, they all tend to believe in applied science when they're lying in a hospital bed, but not necessarily at other times. And it would be nice to see some consistency from those people, you know.
Well, I think, you know, the thing you have to accept it all. If you're using a cell phone, then you're accepting science as the explanation for things, the way things happen. And therefore, when it comes to evolution or something like that, I think you also are forced to accept the scientific explanation. You're utilizing science. Science works. And the best scientists in the world tell you if something's happening. I think you should believe it.
Yes. So let's avoid the reactionary Americanism about this and talk about what's really going on factually with your studies of climate change and what do they tell us?
Well, you know, I'm most interested in the long-term climate change.
Yes.
And how over hundreds of millions of years, well, tens of millions to hundreds of millions of years, there have been these changes in climate. There have been major ice ages. And also between those, there have been major warm periods. So like the dinosaur epoch 100 million years ago or so, we know that the composition of the Earth's atmosphere was quite different then. There was a lot more CO2, and the whole Earth was warm, and that's where the dinosaurs flourished. And we know in the past 40 or 50 million years, the climate has gotten cooler. And finally, we have of the last maybe million years, we have ice sheets covering large portions of the continents, and that's been happening on a fairly regular schedule, and I think it's due to some geological forces that are varying on this schedule that are giving off either less or more CO2 into the atmosphere, and therefore controlling the long-term climate change.
Mm-hmm.
With CO2. That's causing the global warming that's happening now on a much smaller scale, and it's CO2 over hundreds of millions of years, or tens of millions of years, I should say, that has controlled the long-term global climate. It's plate tectonics, it's volcanism, it's sea level changes that have controlled the long-term climate that we see over the last few hundred million years.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know that. I think we're pretty sure about that. But that's what's happening.
And let's talk about, let's see, I also saw a mention in some of your biography about Snowball Earth. If people don't know what Snowball Earth is, can you explain that to them?
Well, there were this time about 700 or so million years ago when the Earth, it looks as if evidence suggests that the Earth froze over, and that there were processes that removed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to such an extent, and we also know that the sun was somewhat less bright back then. It's brightened mm-hmm. over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was enough to cool the temperature down, where you started to grow ice sheets in the polar regions, and ice is very white. It reflects a lot of sunlight back to space, so the sunlight doesn't get absorbed from the Earth. And once the ice starts growing below a certain latitude on the Earth, it just runs away with itself and covers the whole Earth with ice and snow. And so the whole Earth kind of shuts down. And then it takes millions of years for, again, CO2, volcanism doesn't stop. And so CO2 is being poured into the atmosphere every year from volcanoes. And over millions of years, that's enough CO2 to warm the place up so that the ice sheets and the frozen oceans began to recede, and it gets you out of the Snowball Earth epoch. And I think mm-hmm. part of the reason why that hasn't happened more recently than 700 million years ago is because the sun has gotten brighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's harder, there's more energy coming in. So it's harder to create a Snowball Earth conditions in the last 700,000 years. Before that, 700 million years, sorry. Before that, it was possible. Now it's not very likely that could happen.
And that gradual brightening of the sun, although it is gradual, the sun is, of course, a variable star, and that relates to the fact that years ago I ran across this paper that you had co-authored in the Annual Review of Astronomy and Astrophysics, and it absolutely stopped me dead in my tracks and was mind-blowing. And as you know, you were gracious enough, kind enough to read a chapter of my book that's coming out this fall that talks a lot about this, but this gets into the future of life on Earth as well. And we know, of course, that conservatively, the earliest life on Earth is 3.4 billion years old, maybe older than that mm-hmm. as well. But we know that perhaps now, less than a billion years from now, life will come to an end on our planet. So the majority of the history of life on Earth has taken place already. This blew my mind reading your paper on the Goldilocks problem.
That is a mind-blowing thought, yes.
Tell us a little bit for those, because I wasn't aware of it some years ago, and I know a lot of astronomy enthusiasts are not really aware of this, but it's an incredible paper that you and Ken wrote about this.
Well, it is interesting, that we on Earth we were lucky, and we ended up in what's called the habitable zone around the sun, where the temperatures stay pretty much, at least in some places, stay above the freezing point of water. So you can have liquid water on a planet in that habitable zone, and it can have a relatively long history. If you look at other planets like Venus, which is outside the zone, I should say inside the zone, it's too close to the sun, and it's underwent a runaway greenhouse effect, and it's now incredibly hot. And the other side, outside the habitable zone, you have Mars, and Mars looks like it once had a relatively habitable place. It looks like the atmosphere was much thicker. There was much more CO2 in the atmosphere. It was warm enough for liquid water, and it went on for a while, maybe long enough for life to get started. We don't really know yet whether or not there's life on Mars, very primitive life. But Mars shut down, and it shut down basically because it's too small a planet. The planets heat up inside from radioactive decay, and then they lose that heat over the course of time. And if a planet is too small, the heat gets out too easily. And the Earth is lucky in a second sense of being large enough so that the bulk of the Earth seals in that internal heat and keeps the geological engines, you know, that produce gases that go into the atmosphere and produce the motions of plate tectonics. That will keep going for at least probably several billion year, more years. And so we were lucky to be in this habitable zone and to be a large enough planet, to maintain its geological activity, and therefore its atmosphere and liquid water. And you look at the moon is exactly the same distance from the sun as the Earth. It's in the habitable zone, certainly, but it's so small a planet that the heat that was generated in its early stages, both from bombardment of things coming in and hitting the surface, and also from radioactive decay of things that were incorporated in it, the moon died, you know, about 3 billion years ago. It's been dead since then. And the problem is too small a planet. If it had been as big as the Earth, you would have a double planet here, and I'm sure that the situation on the moon would be just as habitable as the situation on the Earth. But this size comes into the equation. And does the small planets end, whereas the larger ones manage to survive? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, but this Goldilocks zone, and of course we're seeing this concept bandied about everywhere now in the booming cottage industry of discovering exoplanets in star systems nearby us in the Milky Way, of course. But this is not only a fixed thing, but it's also a changing aspect, and the sun's radiation, the overall total radiation emitted by the sun. We're living in the right time because another billion years and probably fragile creatures like us will no longer be here because the oceans will boil off and that will be it. And there may be subsurface microbes for a while, but we're not so totally concerned about that after we're knocked off, eh?
No complex life, yeah. Hopefully, and the other problem is, of course, the sun going red giant destroying the Earth. And I guess most people would think, well, maybe we'll be someplace else by then. We will have moved off this dangerous Earth to some other places and spread ourselves across the galaxy. And that may or may not be true, but that's one possibility. We won't be here anymore when the Earth does shut down.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's if we escape other things like we mentioned, supernovae and gamma ray bursts and antimatter and all kinds of exotic things that could happen. But it's incredible because, I mean, thinking backwards, this has had to be one of the great philosophical questions since the dawn of humanity. You know, what will eventually happen to us on this planet? Now we more or less know what that outcome might be. That's really, really quite incredible.
Yeah, it's not a good outcome.
No, it's not a good outcome. It doesn't end well, the story. But then again, we don't have to sell our stocks yet because a billion years is a long time between friends.
That's right. It's not going to happen for billions of years, so we don't have to worry about those things. Asteroids and comets, however, we really do have to worry about. Because there could be one out there that has our name on it.
Yes.
And we haven't yet establish the positions of all the asteroids that are out there. There are a number that we still don't know where they are and when they're going to come in close to the Earth. And so there's an ongoing program of observing asteroids down to as small size as possible with the telescopes that we have, and then plotting their orbits to see if in the next 50, 100 years, maybe, whatever, whether they're going to be in the same place as the Earth, which would mean that there'd be an impact. And then, of course, the question is, could we do something to prevent that impact from taking place, like changing the path of the asteroid or comet that's on its way towards us?
Yes, and the old realization that these impacts won't stop just because we now know about them.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you're... A lot of stuff out there going to affect us at one point or another, hopefully not in the near future, so that we would have enough time to put together a strategy for deflecting any objects that might be coming in on Earth-threatening orbits.
Yes, and you're actually involved in working with some astronomers on some asteroid studies with some folks at Mount Wilson, or you have been in the past.
Yes, we were looking at Juno. Mount Wilson has an old telescope. It's a 100-inch telescope, which was first used by Hubble.
Yes.
To establish the expanding universe, to see the galaxies were moving away from us by their redshift. And the Hubble and then after that, new telescopes like the Palomar Observatory Telescope, and now we have, the Space Telescope, the Hubble, they circumvented, they went beyond the capabilities of the 100-inch. But the thing is that now, with technology, we can put adaptive optics, we call it, on the 100-inch telescope and make it as good as a much larger. We can cancel out the effects of the moving atmosphere above the telescope with this this technical fix, and we can make the 100-inch telescope as good as things that telescopes that are much larger mirrors. And so one of the things we did was using this adaptive optics approach, we studied the asteroid Juno, which is not an Earth-crossing and not asteroids, so we don't have to worry about Juno hitting us, but we can actually see evidence of a large impact. A big chunk of Juno had been taken out of Juno. There was this big scar on the asteroid, and it happened about a half a billion years ago, about 500 million years ago. People, we and other people suggest that is when this another large object smashed into Juno and maybe created meteorites, pieces of Juno that have been on Earth crossing orbits and have come in to the Earth as what we call ordinary chondrites. They mm-hmm. have similar composition as the spectral composition of the Juno asteroid. That event happened about half a billion years ago. So we were able to get a lot out of using the adaptive optics on an old telescope, which worked very well.
An old but quite historic telescope.
Very historic telescope, yes.
Yes, indeed. And I need to ask you, we only have a few minutes left, Mike, but you've gone to so many places with your scientific investigations. What are that's one thing that's nice about astronomy, about geology, about biology. It takes you to some pretty cool places on the planet.
Yes.
When you're investigating this stuff, what do you have any stories or memories or thoughts on what some of the most interesting places you've gone in your work?
Well, one of my favorite places is Krakatoa, which is a volcano that erupted in 1883 and did have effects on the atmosphere that were noted all around the world. And the climate did cool on a global scale for a couple of years after Krakatoa, but it basically destroyed the island and left behind a big hole in the ground. And in that hole, over the last 100 or so years, has been growing a new volcano. And that's how these volcanoes work. They destroy themselves, and then a new volcano builds up in the space that was made by the older volcano. Mm-hmm. And so there's a cycle volcanic activity. And you could go, you could get very close. This is called Anak Krakatoa. It's a small volcano which is actually building. And I went there in 1979 with other volcanologists, and I went back in 2004, and the thing had grown more than twice the size that it was when I was there in the 25 years. It was amazing to see, go someplace and see a geological change, you know, that you can actually see that has happened in your lifetime.
In such a short time scale.
Short time, yes. Yeah. I was very impressed by that visiting Krakatoa after 25 years. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's incredible. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and I'm afraid we're running out of time here, but you really demonstrate the ability to be brave with science, because you've taken on with virtually all of your research has been really daring stuff that combines multi-disciplines together and is tough research, and it's amazing what you've done. So it's been a great pleasure to have you here with me today.
Yeah, well, that's the most interesting stuff. The most interesting stuff tends to be the stuff that's on the cutting edge. And you have to stick your neck out from time to time and propose things that may or may not be true, but can be tested, is the major thing about science.
Absolutely, and it hasn't been easy, but it's been a spectacular career that you've had working on everything. And thanks so much again, Mike. I certainly appreciate you joining me, and I know the listeners will have a wonderful time hearing about all of your thoughts.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.